information, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Right, well, thank you for being patient. Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome John here. I've known John on and off for a few years, but Helen's known him for many years. John is really a key player in the world of astrology. And that doesn't mean that he's a one-trick pony, because, as you're about to hear, he's got many interesting views on a lot of subjects. But John is the editor of the Astrological Journal, which is, you know, one of the key astrological publications out there. And I know that not everybody's convinced by astrology. Well, if you're not, go and find out about it and stop listening to Brian Cox. Because the evidence is strong. And we're not talking here nonsense, sun reader type stuff. You look at serious psychological astrology, statistically, there is something in it. There is no question. But of course, astrology, it interfaces with so many other subjects. And the subject of synchronicity is something we've talked about on and off here for years as part of other things. And we've never actually covered it properly. So this is an opportunity to. And I'm really glad that John's come along. Thank you for being here. And I have seen John speak before, and I know you're going to have a really interesting time. So we're glad he's here. And please give a warm welcome to John Green.
Thank you, everybody. All right, I want to start off by telling you a story, okay? Just imagine me, younger, many years ago, and I was in love with somebody, okay? It had been one of those wonderful chance meetings where you fall in love at first sight, you start, you know, developing this wonderful relationship. And then she dropped a bombshell. She decided she was leaving. She was going to fly off to another country, and although she promised me that she would return and everything would be fine again, I knew in my heart it wasn't going to happen. So, basically, one morning I had to get up early to drive her to Heathrow to drop her off, okay? Knowing that this would probably be the last time I ever saw her. So we got into my car, I started the engine, and I put my iPod on shuffle. And this song came on. Turned to me, as you can imagine, and she said, "Did you play that song on purpose?" And I said, "No, it's on shuffle." And she sighed, a heartfelt sigh, and we both went, "Ah, a temporary coincident occurrence of an a-causal event," because we were both familiar. So tonight, I want to explore, you know, a little bit about synchronicity, and it's not always the easiest topic to talk about. And I hope everyone sort of checked their preconceptions at the door along with their fibre, because I'm going to play around with it a little bit. And you know, I want to make you think in different ways about it. So I want to spend the first part of this talk sort of explaining what synchronicity is and how it works, and then I'll probably spend the next part absolutely destroying it. And we'll see what we're left with at the end, and hopefully we might be able to draw a few conclusions, but I'm not promising that you won't leave with more questions than answers. So the term synchronicity was coined by Dr. Carl Jung here, to describe what he called the temporally coincident occurrence of a-causal events. Okay, Jung, the master of the soundbite. So he spoke of synchronicity as being this a-causal connecting principle. And what that means is it's an experience of having two or more things happen simultaneously in a way that is meaningful to the person that's experiencing them. They feel there's this underlying pattern. And it's not the same as coincidence, because synchronicity implies not just these things happening at the same time, but this underlying pattern or dynamic that becomes meaningful. The a-causal bit is important because it doesn't follow the causal pattern we're used to in science. So you know, A causes B to happen, which then triggers C to happen, etc., and it follows in a linear way. That's not how it works. So there's a famous story of how the synchronistic experience Jung had. And in a dream, he met a figure with the wings of a kingfisher. And he decided he wanted to sketch that. So while drawing in his garden, he found the body of a dead kingfisher. And these birds are probably, well, actually are apparently extremely rare in the area around Zurich where he lived. And this extraordinary, you know, coincidence brought up these strong feelings in him. He had an inner meaning to it. And possibly made anyone around him wary of him sketching them, I imagine. Now, you're probably all familiar, you know, with these situations that make you think, you know, this can't be a coincidence. The classic, you know, you're thinking of someone and the phone rings and it's them. Or you read something in a book and then it just seems wherever you go, you know, you see an advert that brings up similar things, or you pick up a newspaper and it's mentioning a similar thing, you know, thinking, well, this is weird. So these incidents, you know, occur simultaneously, but obviously one's not causing the other. They seem to be connected in a different way, and this is what synchronicity is. And it was a principle that Jung felt compassed his concepts of archetypes and the collective. And it was descriptive of a governing dynamic that sort of underlay all of human experience and history, both social, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. Now, in his book, In the Structure and the Dynamics of the Psyche, Jung describes how, during his research into the phenomena of the collective unconscious, which is the idea that there is, you know, an unconsciousness that links all of us, and buried within there is the archetypal systems, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And so he began to observe these coincidences connected in such a meaningful way that they seem to, you know, defy probability. And he mentions another one in his case studies, and it's the scarab story. And he says, a young woman I was treating had, at a critical moment, a dream in which she was given a golden scarab. While she was telling me the dream, I sat with my back to the closed window. Suddenly, I heard a noise behind me, like a gentle tapping. I turned round and saw a flying insect knocking against the window pane from outside. I opened the window and caught the creature in the air as it flew in. It was the nearest analogy to the golden scarab that one finds in our latitudes, a scarabaeid beetle. Which is that one in the middle. It's called the common rose chafer, and contrary to its usual habits, it evidently felt an urge to get into a dark room at this particular moment. He says, I must admit that nothing like it ever happened to me before or since, and that the dream of the patient had remained unique in my experience. So, you know, what was responsible for the beetle's arrival? It wasn't Jung, it wasn't the patient, it was a causal, okay, like the eye book on Shuffle. But, as synchronicities do, it came before a profound transformation. Until the appearance of this beetle, the patient that he'd been working with had been very rational, remaining sort of psychologically inaccessible to him. And after the incident with the beetle, her demeanour improved and their sessions grew more profitable for both of them. One more, the mythologist Joseph Campbell relates a similar experience, and he was looking into the mythology of the African Bushmen, and they have a trickster god and creator god called Mantis, after the praying mantis. In the middle of his work, he had this sudden urge to open a window, which he'd never opened before, overlooking 6th Avenue in Manhattan. And there at the 14th floor window was one of these, crawling up the wall towards him. Perfect synchronicity. And of course other people would have gone, that's weird, what's the praying mantis doing climbing up the wall in Manhattan? But because of, you know, the work he was doing, it had meaning to them, so this is what synchronicity is all about. Now, because Jung believed the phenomenon of synchronicity was, you know, primarily concerned with psychic conditions, he felt that such couplings of inner and outer reality evolved through the influence of archetypes. And these are patterns inherent in the human psyche and shared by all of mankind. These patterns, or primordial images, if you like, make up man's collective unconscious, representing the dynamic source of all human confrontation, whether it's with death, conflict, love, sex, relationships, mystical experience, rebirth, you know, the whole gamut. And when an archetype is activated by an emotionally charged event, which is something like a tragedy or something, then Jung said that other related events tend to draw near. It's almost like it attracts these other events to happen around it. In this way, the archetypes become a doorway that provides access to the experiences of meaningful and often, you know, insightful coincidence. So at first sight, you know, these coincidences can seem trivial, you know, a bit insignificant, like the slip of the tongue. You know, we hear sometimes of a big dream that, you know, has a premonition about, you know, earth-shattering event, etc. And they do happen, but they're fairly rare. And the vast majority of coincidences, you know, less dramatic, chiefly characterised by this, by lack of meaning, and not by meaning, that's in synchronicity. But because they're so bizarre, the symbolic attitude endows them with a significance and sets off the transcendental function. When this happens, because there's an emotional affect, the coincidence becomes meaningful, and it becomes a synchronicity, as Jung defines it, and an archetypal foundation is at play beneath it. This is very rapid. He is convinced these archetypes were, you know, what underlay synchronistic events. So, we need to look at probability next. And we'll be looking at some more examples later, but initially, you know, if you think about how science normally views chance events. Basically, maths, physics, probability, these are based on the principle that we can't make predictions about a single event. To gain a probability of what might happen, science needs to look at a large number of occurrences to gain a greater degree of accuracy. But there's a problem with scientific model. Take this big heap of rocks up here. Okay? Now, they're all different sizes, but you could say with accurate, you know, scientific accuracy that their average size is, for example, 5 cubic centimetres. But if you wanted to pick up a stone that was exactly 5 cubic centimetres, you wouldn't be able to do it. You might find one if you were very, very lucky, but you'd probably find not a single one. That, this idea of averages is just an abstraction. It's not real. It's helpful in science, but the individual or unique case doesn't concern science, because mathematically we can't get to it. By probability, we can say, you know, a coin will come heads if we throw it now, 50% of the time. But that doesn't tell us what it will come down right now if we threw it. We tend to put a lot of faith in statistics in the modern world, and they keep being sort of shoved at us. And, you know, at times they can be inaccurate beyond the abstract. You know, but then, I mean, I think it was Vic Reeves that says 96.7% of statistics are made up on the spot. And they're getting sort of more meaningless all the time. I don't know if you remember, we used to be told that 8 out of 10 cats preferred whiskers. And then it became 8 out of 10 cat owners, because the cats couldn't actually tell you that they preferred whiskers. And then it was 8 out of 10 cat owners that expressed a preference. And now they've got a thing where they have to put a bit at the bottom that says, you know, 24 people out of a sample of 30 says that. And they just get more meaningless all the time, because they don't tell us about a real event. But we get carried away with these archetypal ideas. And science, you know, a lot of the errors that happen in science are when people become fascinated with a sort of archetypal ideal, which stops them from observing, you know, the real facts. It's called, you know, it's the spell of the archetype. It's something, we want something to happen so much that we look for it. My old chemistry teacher used to say to me, you know, if the facts don't fit the theory, then ignore the facts. And there's still a lot of that going on. Now, there are particular archetypes, you know, linked with synchronicity more than others. And we'll be looking at those. But I just want to admit that the calculus of probability was invented by the French mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal, and another Frenchman, Pierre de Fermat, who you've probably heard of, with the Fermat's theorem, which is one of the most difficult things to work out in mathematics. And basically, a gambler wrote to Pascal and said, "Have you got a system for gambling?" And Pascal thought, that's interesting. And so he wrote to his friend Fermat, and basically they sent letters backwards and forwards and basically worked out probability. And that's where it comes from, gambling. So if the root of all probability is gambling, then the archetypal root of that, because there is an archetype, which is the gambler. And basically the archetype of the gambler is a risk taker, you know, someone who plays the odds. And it's got far more aspects than just, you know, what are commonly considered, like a card sharp, or, you know, somebody who gambles at a racetrack, etc. But you've also got things like drug addicts, entrepreneurs, people playing the stock exchange. The gambler is also active in, you know, the psyche of people, you know, say, engage in politics or celebrity to an extent. People, you know, that take risks with their own reputation by putting themselves out there in the public. From a sort of energy perspective, gambling is an attempt to outrun the speed at which ordinary change occurs. So, you know, the idea of acquiring great wealth in a casino by the one spin of the roulette wheel or winning the lottery, you know, it's a spectacular experience. It's not just because of the money involved, but it's the experience of outrunning time, of beating the odds. So you get the positive aspect of the gambler, which is about following hunches, you know, believing in your own intuition, etc. So, you know, from people in scientific research, property ventures, you know, research, police hunches, all that type of thing, that would come under the gambler. But there's also a negative side to the gambler, you know, which is more of a compulsion. Some people are obsessed with, you know, winning the lottery, striking it rich at the casino, or in, you know, get-rich-quick schemes, or the pyramid schemes, or the emails that go around saying, oh, you know, if you send me your bank account details, I'll leave you the money from the Nigerian prince. And it becomes the focus of their life, this idea of beating the odds. You know, and it may not be, again, about the money, it's this compulsion to have to beat the odds, etc. And this is a related form of gambling, you know, which focused on looking for lucky breaks in your relationships instead of having to do the hard work that keeping a relationship going for years and years, you know, requires. Now, the whole point of this probability is to eliminate chance, and the whole problem of statistics is to do that. And it's used all the time by insurance companies, obviously. You know, they try and eliminate the wild things on the outside of the chance, so they try and look for the average driver and how many accidents they had, or the average homeowner and how many burglaries they had, etc. But chance still plays tricks on us. And under, you know, the English law, we have the wonderful term for chance not foreseen by insurance companies, which is act of God. Now, there's another archetype that plays into this, and it's the trickster. This is Anansi the spider. And almost as far back as our earliest written records, the trickster appears as a key figure, you know, in human drama. He's usually a human or an animal character that plays dubious jokes or tricks, makes fun or is made fun of, and may be camouflaged as a sort of demigod of a religious tradition. If you take the serpent in the Bible, it's based on similar characters in Sumerian Babylonian mythology from at least the 3rd millennium BC, in which a serpent tricks humanity out of immortality and takes it for itself. Now, the Greeks had a nice term about it. The Greek trickster god is called Hermes. And in a room full of conversation, you know, you occasionally get this lull of silence. And at such times, the ancient Greeks used to say that Hermes had entered the room. And Hermes symbolizes the penetration of boundaries with his winged sandals and his cap of invisibility. And he brings the numinous power of the unconscious into the world of ordinary experiences. He brings with him the ability to catalyze synchronistic events. The trickster stirs up synchronicity. And instead of, you know, a normal room, the room could be the human mind. You know, in the conversation, all the voices that we have going on within our own mind. And when these are silenced, it's possible for the archetypes to move forward to expression. And this activation is what Jung considers the cornerstone of synchronicity. And in his thinking, the activation or awakening of these archetypes releases a great deal of power. It's almost like splitting the atom inside you. There's a build-up of energy at this most primitive and sort of undifferentiated level. Personality, and it overflows and sort of leaks out into the outside world and attracts these different events to it. Okay. Now, implicit in Jung's sort of understanding of this concept of synchronicity was the belief in the ultimate oneness of the universe. As Jung expresses it, such phenomenon shows an interdependence between external objective events and the subjective or psychic state of the observer or observers. And Jung claimed to have found evidence of this interdependence, not just in psychiatry, but in esoteric practices. Now, he first started off looking at the I Ching, which is the Chinese system of, you know, predicting events by throwing coins or sticks, etc., and then observing where they fall and reading them from the hexagrams. Now, of the I Ching, Jung wrote, "The Chinese mind, as I see it at work in the I Ching, seems to be exclusively preoccupied with the chance aspect of events. What we call coincidence seems to be the chief concern of this peculiar mind, and what we worship as causality passes almost unnoticed. While the Western mind carefully sifts, weighs, selects, classifies, isolates, the Chinese picture of the moment encompasses everything down to the minutest nonsensical detail, because all of the ingredients make up the observed moment." Now, what he means in his slightly racist way of putting things, actually, is that, you know, he saw that the Eastern mind as being more philosophical, and so having no problem in viewing events which occur together, and, you know, looking at them in a way of what happens internally as well as what is happening externally. So, you know, not seeing any problem within that. Whereas, you know, to the Western mind and the sort of scientific mind, that's, they're often separated out. It's not to do with what we feel inside and linking to it. To Jung, the unconscious knows things. It knows the past, it knows the future, knows things about other people. And this knowledge Jung called absolute knowledge. And to explore his theory further, Jung found the best instances of his theory were cases of ESP, or extrasensory perception, parapsychology, numerology, and astrology. And he believed he found direct evidence for the existence of a causal combination of events through the experiments of J.B. Ryan. And what J.B. Ryan did, I don't know if you've seen these before, these are Zener cards, they're called, and they're used for ESP testing. And so you've got a circle, cross, wavy line, square, and a star. And basically, the subjects are asked to guess, you know, what symbols are on the cards as they turned up. Okay? And while the results vary, in many cases the results were distinctly above probability, Jung said. And the likelihood of success seemed to depend on how the subject approached the experiment. People that were eager and enthusiastic and wanted it to work, better results. People that didn't think it was going to work, poor results. And if the test subject was a strong believer in SP, you know, even better. For Jung, the upshot of these experiments basically affirmed that synchronicity worked. Now, what I want to do is have a go at an ESP experiment right now. Okay? And I've got an old video. It's a bit wonky, probably a bit like your UFO video, because it's quite old. But I'm just going on. Can I have a volunteer? Someone who doesn't mind joining in. So have a think. No, I just need to...
Any volunteers? John?
Yes,
I knew you'd do it. Yeah, we've got a volunteer.
We've got a volunteer. Okay, fine. Right. All I need is you follow the instructions. Sorry, you can stay in your seat, don't worry. Follow the instructions of the video, and then you'll be asked to think of the card, and then just if you say it out loud so that we can all hear the card you're thinking of, and then I can restart the video.
Welcome to the Biology for Enhanced Perception Testing. In this section of the video, you will be asked to make some decisions based on the five drawn shapes. The circle, the cross, the wavy lines, the square, and the star. In each instance of this experiment, Ivan Leonov will be transmitting to you one of the shapes, randomly predetermined by our scientist. For best results, an assistant should be available to help control the environment and record the results. It is advised that you sit 6 feet from the screen and allow your mind to become receptive to this video now. Look at the five symbols as they are arranged on the table. Ivan is transmitting the thought of one of these shapes to you now. This video will pause to give the transmission time to take effect. Please say out loud the name of the symbol that you feel mentally drawn to. Press play to continue.
Circle.
The circle. Thank you. Isn't it a wonderful video, eh?
Ivan is transmitting the circle.
Good start.
Move on to test two.
Right, so let's try test two. See how you do.
Once more, Ivan is going to transmit one of the five shapes to you. The probability of you being correct twice in a row is only 4%. Concentrate now. Please say out loud the name of the symbol that you feel drawn to in your mind. Press play to continue.
Square. The square. Thank you.
The incorrect shapes will now be removed, leaving only the mentally transmitted shape. The square. If you are successful once more, then you may possess a potential for enhanced perception. Please continue on to test 3.
Okay, we have one final test. Let's see how you do.
In this test, there's only one shape used. It is being transmitted to you now. Is it the circle, the cross, the wavy lines, the square, or the star? Please say out loud the name of the symbol that you feel mentally drawn to and press play to continue.
The star?
Pentagram. That's a specific type of star. So.
If you were thinking of the circle, congratulations. Oh. The likelihood of being correct 3 times in a row is less than 1%. Only possessing natural psychic ability.
Oh, nearly. Yeah. You're halfway there, right?
If you were thinking of the cross.
Okay. Now, this is what Jung, you know, was working. So I'm just going to put back the other thing. So, did you ever feel you were psychic?
Well, yeah, I think everyone is.
So Jung decided, you know, after the working with the I Ching and with the ESP experiments, that synchronicity also extended to astrology. And in a letter to Freud, dated June the 12th, 1911, he wrote, "My evenings are taken up largely with astrology. I make horoscopic calculations in order to find a clue to the core of psychological truth. Some remarkable things have turned up which will appear incredible to you. I dare say that we shall one day discover in astrology a good deal of knowledge that has been intuitively projected into the heavens." And what he did, he made an analysis of 483 pairs of charts from married couples chosen at random. And he found a sort of preponderance of signifiers within the charts that would signify a strong relationship between the man and the woman. Most notably, the moon of a woman was found to be in conjunction with either the sun, moon, or the ascendant rising sign of her husband. And they did a control group of over 32,000 unmarried pairs of charts, so just picking charts at random for people that weren't married. And they didn't show these aspects in a significant way. And the analysis indicated the results obtained could have happened by chance about one time in 10,000. So he was quite encouraged by this. And there's been, you know, experiments after that. A later study in Germany, they looked at horoscopes of accident-prone persons. Basically a group of car drivers who had more than, you know, the average amount of car accidents and had a risky driving style, if you like. Now, in astrology, we'd often ascribe that to, you know, behaviour to the planet Mars and to Uranus, turning up in sort of dominant positions in the horoscope. And so this German Society of Astrologers, they did this test, and they found that, you know, astrologers could pick 5 out of 6 people that were, you know, more likely to be accident prone from the things they had. And so again, it seemed very positive, but the test amount was quite small, so they needed to do it on a larger scale, which hasn't been done yet. But it's not all positive, okay? When Geoffrey Dean showed a large group of astrologers what they believed to be the Singapore Tula Clark's chart, they gave out these descriptions of what they thought her chart was like, and, you know, tended to match her personality. You know, she's young and sparky and bubbly and singing or whatever. Problem was, the chart he'd given them was actually Charles Manson's. And so, you know, there was this worrying fear that maybe, you know, astrologers were just making it up, you know, when they were told something. I have to say, we don't all do that, okay, but it can happen. Now, you know, what Jung suggested that this, you know, astrology could be based on this principle of synchronicity, you know, that the influence of the stars doesn't work in a causal sense, i.e., you know, Saturn being there, making an aspect to your chart down here, it's not Saturn doing something to you in itself. It's the synchronicity that Saturn is in the sky in a particular position, matches a position in your chart, and the events occur together. So that was how he viewed it, as synchronistically. And so he saw astrology as working, if you like, you know, in a way that's described by this old saying, what is below is like what is above, and what is above is like what is below, so that the miracle of the one may be accomplished. One could say that the universal is reflected in the specific. It should therefore be possible to draw conclusions, you know, regarding earthly events from planetary constellations. Now, the astrologer Liz Green says, the positions of the heavens at a particular moment in time, by reflecting the qualities of the moment, also reflect the qualities of anything born at that moment. One does not cause the other. They are synchronous and mirror each other. And although this is probably a sort of slightly extended idea of synchronicity, because it doesn't simply refer to an individual and his relationship with the direct environment, in fact, it seems, you know, everything in the universe as being interconnected in a meaningful way. And as physics advances, you know, the suggestion of the interconnectedness of everything is certainly something that there could be a possibility that they're trying to find, you know, the theory of everything, something that brings everything together. And in formulating this synchronicity principle, Jung was very much influenced by what was then the new physics of the time, you know, what Einstein was doing with the theory of relativity and the start of quantum physics. Physics, wrote Jung in 1946, has demonstrated that in the realm of atomic magnitudes, objective reality presupposes an observer, and that only on this condition is a satisfactory scheme of explanation possible. Or the short version is, you know, the observer influences events, which they have found, you know, is important when looking at things on this atomic level. And so, you know, he saw it, you know, that there was a subjective element attaches to the physicist's world picture, and that a connection necessarily exists between the psyche to be explained by him, basically. And these discoveries, you know, didn't just sort of loosen the iron grip of physics from the old Newtonian worldview of everything working very mechanically, but confirmed what Jung had believed, that matter and consciousness, far from operating sort of independently of one another, were linked. But there is at the heart, you know, a sort of fundamental problem at the heart of Jung's description of synchronicity. You know, his attempt, you know, to sort of bring together the irrational and the, you know, the existential experience along with theory. And basically he was trying to make a theory out of it, if you like. One of his biographers, Ira Progoff, who was a Jungian psychologist as well, basically, you know, noted that Jung had, you know, this absolute obsession with the way science was going, and he so wanted to emulate Einstein by having his own theory to match Einstein's theory of relativity. And so there was a lot driving him to try and get there, to try and, you know, he wanted to have his place in the world alongside Einstein. And I mean, it's interesting, really, that Einstein's quote, you know, God does not play dice with the universe, sort of goes against the whole idea of synchronicity in the first place. Now, during the course of, you know, him developing the synchronicity idea, there evolves what his biographer refers to as a double conception, which is pointed out by one of his followers, Marie-Louise Malfrance. And she says, when Jung put forward his hypothesis of the principle of synchronicity, there was much discussion as to whether one could not still discover a law under which synchronistic events would have a certain regularity or would follow certain laws. This law has not been possible to find, and Jung, after long reflection and discussion, came to the conclusion that we have to admit, much as it annoys our rational minds, that synchronistic events are just so stories. So that was, they never managed to actually put something together as to say why this is happening. They could just say, this is an interesting story, and this is what we feel might happen. But the very nature of synchronicity is just basically impossible to prove. So, just one more thing with astrology. This is the chart of Earth, and I know in the re-chart, this is something we look at every day, just for fun. But this is the chart of the Chernobyl nuclear reactor disaster in April 26, 1986. And this interconnectedness of things, very quickly, well, one of the things basically was happening near an eclipse, and the eclipses have always been seen as, you know, things of bad omen. And the eclipse had literally happened just a couple of days before. And then it's also the day of the sun. See, the sun's here at 5 degrees, being directly opposite Pluto at 5 degrees. Mm. So that one day. Mm. And Pluto has long been linked in astrology with the nuclear world, if you like. So, you know, this is the type of thing you can look at in astrology and say, well, there is something going on here. You know, this is synchronistic. But best not to get too carried away with this. Okay. Even astrologers, the astrologer and psychologist Mike Harding writes about synchronicity extensively in his book called Hymns to Ancient Gods, which is well worth reading, actually. And he says, the psychologist Marie-Louise in France restates the principle of synchronicity as a meaningful coincidence of an external event with an inner motive, from dreams, fantasies, or thoughts. It must concern two or more elements which cannot, for an observer, be connected causally, but only in their meaning. As astrology can be demonstrated to work with earthquakes, nuclear power plants, chemical processes, and a host of mundane events, which presumably neither dream, fantasize, then we have to recognize the possibility of an external or underlying principles at work, which have nothing specifically to do with human life. But if this is the case, however they operate, it can't be synchronistic. Now that's quite a strong view from Mike Harding. I think the thing is that everything that happens in the world is observed by someone who fantasizes, theories, has dreams, etc. So I think it's a little bit beyond the point. But his second point about how maybe astrology doesn't work with synchronicity is probably more important. There was a series of work done by a Frenchman called Michel Gauquelin many years ago, which has some controversy about it, but in general he found that, for example, a very powerful placement of Mars, which was generally sort of just 10 degrees above the horizon, was very prominent in the charts of athletes. And likewise, Saturn in a similar position was very common in the charts of scientists, the moon for writers, and so on. And he published a lot of data on this. And he actually started out as a skeptic, looking to sort of disprove this, and then gradually got drawn in and realised he was actually proving it worked to some extent. But, nice though this data is for astrologers, the problem is it then throws a bit of a spanner in the works for synchronicity, because it can't be a synchronistic event. Because basically, we're not recording when the planet is 10 degrees above the horizon. We're recording when we see the light in that planet. So therefore, for light from Saturn can take up to an hour and 20 minutes to come from Saturn to Earth. So the real Saturn would have aligned with that horizon an hour and 20 minutes before we see it. But then Mars, nowhere near as far, so it wouldn't be happening at the same time. So this then suggests that, you know, we're seeing an event that's dependent on the speed of light. And as the speed of light obviously does fall within the domain of space-time physics, it can't be, in Jung's own words, a synchronistic event, because he says, as the time factor is indispensable to the concept of causality, one cannot speak of causality in a case where the time factor is eliminated. Now, far from being eliminated, the time factor is central to the success of this data. And if it was not for the case, we wouldn't get this precise 10 degrees. Okay. So that sort of blows that bit a little bit out of water. And interestingly, Jung also wrote later on, 6 years before his death, he wrote this. It is especially not understood what an excellent joke was made with the use of astrological statistics. People have even thought that I wanted to prove something in vain of astrology. It is hardly worthwhile to deal with all this pack of nonsense. So cheers, Jung. but yeah, so he writes these wonderful letters to Freud to start off with, and then towards the end of his life, I'd like to think that it's partly his desire to be seen up as Einstein, as a scientist, rather than something more philosophical that he turned his back on it, but we'll never know. He can't tell us. So, you know, are there any reasons for accepting synchronicity as an explanation for anything in the real world? Are there perhaps better and simpler methods of explaining synchronistic events? Well, yes, and quite a lot of them. Even Jung's defense of sort of these acausal connections are not always the strongest. He says things like, acausal phenomena must exist since statistics are only possible anyway if there are also exceptions. And he says, improbable facts exist, otherwise there would be no statistical mean. So he has all these sort of double bluffs and tricksy sort of terminology to say. So I want to look now at some of the things, you know, how might we have these synchronistic events otherwise? Okay. Is there a way, you know, for us to prove that we can still experience many meaningful coincidences? Well, in fact, Littlewood's law states that individuals can expect a miracle a month. Now this law, it's a nice thought, isn't it? This law was framed by Cambridge University professor J. Littlewood, and it was published in a collection of his work called A Mathematician's Miscellany, and it seeks to, you know, sort of debunk one part of, you know, sort of paranormal activity or phenomena. And it's related to his more general and rather wonderfully named law of truly large numbers. And basically states that if you have a sample size large enough, any outrageous thing is likely to happen. Now, how it works, okay, making certain suppositions, a miracle is defined as an exceptional event of special significance occurring at the frequency of about 1 in a million. Now, during the hours in which a human being is awake and alert, a human will experience, say, about one thing a second, like seeing a computer screen or a desk or a person or whatever, and is alert, say, for about 8 hours a day. And as a result, a human will, in 35 days, have experienced, under these suppositions, 1,008,000 things. Accepting this definition of a miracle, one can be expected to observe one miraculous occurrence within the passing of every 35 consecutive days. And therefore, according to this reasoning, seemingly miraculous events are commonplace. Okay, so that's Littlewood's law. But there's another thing, okay, so consider this, have a listen to it. Okay, the Beatles. Now, about September 1969, a rumour started circulating that Paul McCartney was dead. That he was killed in a 1966 car accident and had basically been replaced in the Beatles by a lookalike. And apparently the rumours went, you know, there are clues everywhere. Okay. Now, the song Day of Life, which you just heard, has the lyrics, he blew his mind out in a car, he didn't notice that the lights changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was for the House or the Lords. And apparently that was about Paul. How Paul was supposed to be mistaken for someone from the House of Lords, I don't know, but hey. Now this is the cover of Abbey Road album. And apparently this is a funeral procession. Okay, you've got John at the front in white as the priest. Yeah. Ringo is in black as the pallbearer. A barefoot and out of step John Paul as a corpse. And George has got his work clothes on because he's the gravedigger. Okay. And in the background, okay, you've got this VW Beetle here, okay, and you probably can't see it, but it's got 28IF, okay, as part of the number plate. And that was supposed to be 28 if, which would be Paul's age, if he had survived. Okay. Now, but the best bits were in backwards song. And the song,
Revolution Number 9. If you play it forwards, you hear this.
Number 9,
and so on for about 9 minutes or whatever. But if you play it backwards, as we all like to do, it actually says, "Turn me on, dead man." Sorry, let me go back to that because you need to hear that. Or it could be Welsh, yeah, absolutely. Or it could be, don't play songs backwards.
However, right, over the time, there's more and more rooms of people. I mean, if you want to, just Google, you know, Paul is dead, all right, and you see how many results you get. It's huge. Now, this is despite, I mean, John actually, you know, made a statement to Rolling Stone magazine in 1970 that, honestly, he's not dead, it's the real one. Okay? It's, you know, it's all, some people have made it up, but who made it up? They didn't make it up, you know, and you can't trace one person that made it up. Now, instead, what this is an example of how the brain functions as a sort of pattern recognition machine. And all too often, you can find, you know, patterns in the sort of, just the noise background of life. And it's called a signal-to-noise problem. Now what happens, human beings, you know, evolved brains that are pattern recognition machines, well adapted to sort of detect signals that, you know, threaten, you know, something's going on and might threaten my survival or whatever. And obviously it needs to pick them out amongst the background of the sort of world noise. And this capability is, you know, association learning. So you associated causally, you know, A and B, etc. Same way that our ancestors associated the seasons with the, you know, game animals moving to a different place, etc. And obviously we survive and we pass on our genes to this talent. But unfortunately, you know, it has a few flaws. And often, you know, we get these things. So you get things, for example, that, you know, a superstition where A appears connected to B but it isn't. So like a footballer scores a goal a couple of times wearing his lucky pants. And so he really thinks, well, I have to always wear my lucky pants in order to score. And in the same way, you know, sometimes we perceive the world today as a far more terrifying place, thanks to 24-hour news channels. Because basically our brains are picking up all these, you know, terrible, you know, as you said, from Egypt, from Libya, you know, all these things. But we're used to having these things from our own backyard, you know, way, way back, you know, minds evolved. Obviously, you wanted to know when something dangerous was happening in your backyard. But if you're constantly being fed this information that things are frightening and terrible, then maybe, you know, we go on overload and see things as far more scary than they are. Or do we? God knows how scary we'd be if we did midsummer or something like that. But anyway, this is termed apophenia, okay, which is a lovely word. And it is the experience of seeing patterns or connections in random or meaningless events and data. Now, it was originally coined in 1958 by Klaus Conrad. And he defined it as the unmotivated seeing of connections accompanied by a specific experience of an abnormal meaningfulness. So you can see how it links to the idea of synchronicity. Now, he originally described this phenomenon in relation to the distortion of reality present in certain mental illnesses. But it became, you know, more widely used to describe this tendency, you know, just normal, all of us, without having a neurological or mental illness at the back of it. I mean, if you've seen the film Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe playing John Nash, when he starts to see patterns in all his mathematical research and you know, that and the code breaking and stuff, you know, that's an example of that, and that would be in its traditional sense of being part of a schizophrenic illness. Now, there's a film, if you've ever heard it or seen it, called Dark Side of the Rainbow. Okay. And basically it's a perceived effect you get by playing the 1973 Pink Floyd album, Dark Side of the Moon, at the same time as The Wizard of Oz. Now, depending on the film version you use, because films, you know, can run at a slightly different frame rate, parts of the film and the music, you know, tie up really sort of spot on. And you get almost like a, you know, like a music video experience of having the two. So you've got the sound of The Wizard of Oz off, and you've got Dark Side of the Moon on, and off it goes. And they call it Dark Side of the Rainbow, because obviously a combination of Dark Side of the Moon and Over the Rainbow, the song. And it, again, Google it, and you'll find these websites, well over 100 correspondences do it. And I have sat and watched the whole film do it. It's quite fun if you've got nothing better to do. And a few things. But they also talked about the album artwork. Oh, this is the cover of Dark Side of the Moon. You've probably seen this, but it's cover. And then, you know, they link this in as well, because light comes out, light goes into the prism, comes out coloured. Seeing The Wizard of Oz, film starts out in black and white, goes to Oz, comes out coloured. Yeah. Now, but again, it's apophenia, because nobody did that. You know, all the members of Pink Floyd absolutely denied that they ever even sat there watching Wizard of Oz, really. And also, you know, a lot of the effects that tie in places are effects that were put on in the studio after the band had finished the album. So it's actually nothing to do with the band either, because these synchronistic effects were just things they dropped into the studio, like ticking clocks and, you know. But it's a lovely idea, and, you know, if you find it personally meaningful, then Jung would certainly call it synchronistic. Now, going further, there's a Professor Peter Brugger of the Department of Neurology, in Zurich. And he says the propensity to see connections between seemingly unrelated objects or ideas most closely links psychosis to creativity. Apophenia and creativity may even be seen as two sides of the same coin. And he also notes that he saw it in psychoanalysts. Okay? He noted that one analyst thought he had support for the penis envy theory because more females than males failed to return their pencils at the end of a seminar. But anyway, his research indicates that there's basically a high level of dopamine affect the propensity to find meaning patterns and significance. And apparently New Scientist related, there was a trial done, it was reported in New Scientist in 2002, that this increased level of dopamine and euphoria also marked a belief in paranormal. So that's where they get us now. Now, so that's one of the theories, if you like. That's one of the theories. But I'm going to show you something else. This is a list, okay? This is the list of the 2007 Czechoslovakian National Junior Soccer Team, which made the Junior World Cup finals, okay? Sure, you're really interested in that. However, have a look at the dates of birth, right, of the kids involved. Do you notice something interesting? There is a huge proportion of them. Okay, if you look, these lot were born in January, these lot were born in February, these lot March, April, May, June, August, September. Alright, so you take the first 3 months of the year and you've got 15 out of 21 of them. Now this is from Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers. And he also shows Canadian junior hockey team with similar birthdays. Now, it's got nothing to do with astrology, nor is there anything magical about the first 3 months of the year. It's simply that in Czechoslovakia, the eligibility cutoff for age class football is January the 1st. Now, a boy who turns 10 on January the 2nd could be playing alongside someone who doesn't turn 10 until the end of the year. Now, at that age, you know, they're sort of 9, 10, pre-adolescence, a year's gap is quite a bit in terms of physical maturity. And so, because the coaches start to select players for the good teams, you know, at this age of 9 or 10, they're more likely to view as talented the ones that are bigger and have been you know, playing a bit longer than the ones who may be a little bit less coordinated, etc. Because they've had the benefit of those extra months of, you know, training and maturity. And then, of course, what happens once you get picked for that team, then you get better coaching, your teammates are better, you play more games a season, you practice two or three times more than all the other, you know, the kids in the other teams. And so in the beginning, although the advantage isn't that great, it's just you're a little bit older, a little bit more mature. You know, by the time you get to age 13, 14, 15, because you've had all that better coaching, you know, and better practice, then, you know, you're the ones more likely to make the national squad just because you've been looked after better. Now, it's, you know, it's argued that these sort of skewed age distributions exist when you get selection, streaming, and differential experience. You know, if you make a decision of who's good and who's not good at an early age, you know, if you separate the talented from untalented, and you provide the talented with a superior experience, then you're going to end up giving a huge advantage to that small group of people that you've already selected in the first place. I mean, in England, we do it slightly differently. We had it September 1st instead. And at one point in the Premier League, there were 288 players born between September and November compared to only 136 in England. So you get the same sort of cut there. So again, you know, this is another example of things that you could look at and say, well, that's really meaningful. Why the first 3 months of the year? And sometimes we just have to skew it around and look at it in a different way. Well, hang on, why? Now, in addition, could synchronistic events result from coincidence after all? You know, there are two features of coincidence that we don't always immediately assume. First, we tend to overlook, you know, the powerful reinforcement of coincidences, both waking and in dreams, in our memories. You know, because there's a coincidence, we remember it. If it doesn't relate to each other, then we don't remember it. So, you know, we're already pre-selecting those over another. And secondly, we often fail to realise how often, you know, these improbable things happen to all of us. And we often, you know, tend to assign coincidences a lesser possibility than they deserve. But we can sometimes calculate probabilities of seemingly improbable events. So have a guess, right? If there's 23 people in a room, what are the chances two of them or more will have the same birthday? Any ideas? So that's probably over that here. Any ideas?
One in 100, maybe.
It's actually 50%. There's a maths if you want to work it out. Which I actually can explain, but I don't want to spend time on that. But yes, it actually works out that, you know, in a random selection of 23 people, there's actually a 50% chance at least two of them celebrate the same birthday. And this is the graph here. This line here is the one we're looking at. As you can see, here's the probability. And so you see, it starts off quite small, and then it builds up. And here, at about 23, we get to the 50% mark. And then by the time you get to about 40, you're up to 90% chance that you'll find two. Now, if you extend that to having, so you include one day either side, so not just, they don't just have to be born on your birthday, but they could be born the day before or the day after. You actually hit that 50% mark much earlier here, at about 14 people. But absolutely, you know, we tend to think, well, actually, that'd be really weird to be in a room of people and they've got exactly the same birthday, but actually it's not that uncommon. So again, this is something else, you know, to sort of bear in mind, if you like. So are there other occurrences of probability, you know, that we don't get right either? Now, I'm going to move on to the next one. I'm going to show you a little film. Basically, there was a court case a few years ago in the United States, which was about whether you could teach intelligent design in schools. And obviously, Richard Dawkins got quite up in arms about this, and he went over to the States, you know, and all this sort of thing. And, you know, I don't know whether you may or may not believe in God, in creationism, or intelligent design, or whatever. Although I think a good reason to believe in God, intelligent design, and creationism is Professor Richard Dawkins. because when I look at something as complex and strikingly beautiful as Professor Richard Dawkins, I don't think that could have evolved by chance. I think God put him on this earth to test us. But anyway, yeah, there was this court case. And the intelligent design people kept bringing up, you know, that evolution could not have caused something, say, as complex as an eye, you know, because it takes a huge amount of evolution to go from very simple compound eye to something as complex that we have. And I just showed you a clip, this was from Horizon film, but about the time. So have a look at this, and it sort of explains how, we can look at things in the wrong way.
In 2 days of testimony, Milan attempted to knock down the arguments for intelligent design one by one. Also on his hit list, Dembski's criticism of evolution, that it was simply too improbable.
One of the mathematical tricks employed by intelligent design involves taking the present-day situation and calculating probabilities that the present would have appeared randomly from events in the past. And the best example I can give is to sit down with four friends, shuffle a deck of 52 cards, and deal them out, and keep an exact record of the order in which the cards were dealt. We can then look back and say, my goodness, how improbable this is. We could play cards for the rest of our lives, and we would never, ever deal the cards out in this exact same fashion. You know what? That's absolutely correct. Nonetheless, you dealt them out, and nonetheless, you got the hand that you did.
For Miller, Dembski's maths did not add up. The chances of life evolving, just like the chance of getting a particular hand of cards, could not be calculated backwards. By doing so, the odds were unfairly stacked. Played that way, cards and life would always appear impossible.
So yes, so this is the probability of each hand of cards. If you do that with a card, hand of 30 cards. 1 in 635 billion, 30 million, 550,600. Okay? I've practiced that. but yeah, so it's incredibly improbable. But, you know, if you sit down and you play, say, bridge or whatever, and something like, you know, you have to get a hand of cards. But it's just that each hand that you get, that's the chances of it. So, you know, we're just not used to looking at these big numbers. And what he was saying about the intelligent design thing, you know, is that to calculate backwards, go, oh my God, getting that hand is a probability of that. But you can't look at it that way. You know, you've been dealt out, that's where it is, that's how you have it, and that's the probability of getting that mixture, because, you know, you have got the hand of cards. Okay, let's cut the numbers down a little bit, because it gets that gets a bit ridiculous. Coin tosses, okay? You know, what sequence of heads and tails might you expect random tossing of a coin? This is 100 tosses of a coin, okay? Now, you don't expect to get all heads. You don't expect to get all tails. And you don't expect to get, you know, this wonderfully matching head-tail, 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 alternating. So in a random, you know, sequence, we expect runs of heads and tails and alternation and stuff. And this is the sort of thing you get. Now, but if you start looking through this sort of random data, you can find some regularities, like, you know, this underlined bit here. You've got eight together that went tail, head, tail, head, tail, head, tail, head. Before it was broken again. The probability of, you know, this alternating sequence of eight tosses is once in 27. And there are some long runs of heads, and there are some long runs of tails here. You know, there's even a surprising one of 10 heads. Starting with the head there going all the way through there. And a run of 10 heads should occur only once in 210, but this is in the first 80. So, you know, you can't, the problem with probability is that, you know, although we know it's 50%, we expect to see something roughly 50%, but we don't quite know what that is. You know, it's not proof that coin tosses aren't random. What we have instead is a demonstration that we can always comb random data and find regularities not specified in advance. Now, you know, we might look at that data and think, well, oh, there's 10 heads occurred together in the first 100. We might think we're onto something, that this is a special coin of it. But, you know, it's basically... that, you know, such a run like that will happen, you know, within a pattern of this random data. Now, the point is that, you know, the very nature of something happening randomly assures us that, you know, when you get big amounts of random data, there will be bits of pattern within it. But what the pattern is, you can't specify in advance. And it only becomes, you know, something you can confirm or a theory you can put together when you can confirm in advance where those patterns will occur. Okay. Now, clearly, you know, unspecified improbable coincidences occur daily to probably all of us. Okay? And these coincidences could be patterns in randomness. If you've got a data set that's large enough, you're bound to get coincidences. So let me quote from, you know, the sceptical and beautiful friend Richard Dawkins. He talks about in his book Unweaving the Rainbow, having a mystic on TV saying that he will stop watches. Okay? I think he's talking about Uri Geller, okay, but he's not mentioned. And, you know, people are invited to ring in if their watch stops ticking. And so Dawkins talks about, you know, the probability of such a thing. And he said, well, okay, say a watch battery lasts a year, then the chance of it stopping in any 5-minute period is about 1 in 100,000, which is quite small. But if you've got 10 million people watching the telly, that's 100 people. And then if you add in people that watches don't stop, but their clocks stop, or maybe something weird happens, you know, their telly starts flickering or whatever, you know, you can get quite a sizable number of people phoning and go, something weird's just happening, you know, without actually anything necessarily happening. So, you know, I want to bring it back round to synchronistic, because, you know, it's still getting a little bit bleak. There's a wonderful story about the French writer Émile Deschamps. And in 1805, he was treated to some plum pudding, okay, by the wonderfully named Monsieur de Fontgibault. And he was a stranger at the time, he just met him, but he treated him to the plum pudding. Now, 10 years later, he was in a Paris restaurant, and he saw plum pudding on the menu. And he wanted to order something. He said, can I have some of that plum pudding? And they said, oh, really sorry, the last piece has just gone to Monsieur de Fontgibault over there. And many years later, he was at a dinner party, and once again, plum pudding was on the menu. Okay, he was offered plum pudding, and he told, you know, the dinner party about the other two incidences and how he'd always been Monsieur de Fontgibault. And just as he was telling the story, there's a knock at the door, and by then a very old and senile Monsieur de Fontgibault, who had lost his way and knocked at a random house, was there at the door. I love that story. Now, you know, obviously, because the theory of synchronicity can't be testable by classical scientific method. You know, and so often it's widely not regarded as scientific at all, but more pseudo-scientific or magical. But, you know, to be honest, Jung wouldn't have considered it scientifically testable because you can't take away the person who's having the experience. And that's the whole thing that science tries to do. You know, it creates double-blind tests so that both sets of people don't know what's going on. But the whole point of synchronicity is you have to feel that meaning within you. So it is, you know, impossible. And I think it's pretty much stretching the probability theory to explain events like the plum pudding and Monsieur de Fontgibault. But, you know, some people would say, you know, the correct variables were there. It is just wildly improbable, but not impossible. And I suppose that's true. But maybe it's not all lost, okay? There's mathematician Warren Weidman in his book Lady Luck, The Theory of Probability, tells this wonderful story that sort of stretches it in. And the story originally appeared in Life magazine. And he writes, all 15 members of a church choir in Beatrice, Nebraska, due at practice at 7:20, were late on the evening of March the 1st, 1950. The minister and his wife and daughter had one reason. His wife delayed to iron the daughter's dress. One girl waited to finish a geometry problem. One couldn't start her car. Two lingered to hear the end of an especially exciting radio program. One mother and daughter were late because the mother had to call the daughter twice to wake her from a nap, and so on. The reasons seemed rather ordinary. But there were 10 separate and quite unconnected reasons for the lateness of all 15 people. It was rather fortunate that none of the 15 arrived on time at 7:20, for at 7:25 the church building was destroyed in an explosion. The members of the choir life reported wondering if the delay was, an act of God. And he calculates the odds to this uncanny event as about 1 in a million. So hey, that should happen every month, shouldn't it? So, in conclusion, you know, what can we make of synchronicity? Are we all victims, you know, of this mind's tendency to apophilia? Or is there something much more in what Jung postulated? You know, maybe we have to go for the sluggish verdict of not proven. There are a couple of possibilities, though, of how synchronicity might work. The poster for Flatland there. Now, synchronicity might work with an additional dimension. Okay, bear with me. If you were a one-dimensional being, you'd be able to see the next dimension up, like a 2D surface or a plane, but only as a line at any given time. If you're a two-dimensional, this is what Flatland is about, if you're a two-dimensional being, you can also see the next dimension up, like three dimensions, but you'd only be able to see a plane at a time. So maybe, you know, a square or a circle. You know, so if, for example, you dipped a three-dimensional object, like a tree, into a pond of water, a two-dimensional being on the surface of the water would be able to see the tree, but only as a series of separate sort of thin wooden lines, because they'd just see the plane. And each wooden line would represent one of the branches of the tree in the water. However, from his 2D viewpoint, he wouldn't be able to establish any logical link between this pattern. He would just see, you know, like this interesting pattern. Now, in this manner, it is just conceivable that as three-dimensional beings, we might occasionally get to view a snapshot of a next dimension, fourth dimension, even though there might not be a logical relationship that we could understand between the objects or events in our snapshot. But intuitively, we might know, with little doubt, that a definite relationship exists. Not only could we know, but we could act on that knowledge to deduce a valid outcome in our third-dimensional object. So maybe that's how synchronicity works. Now maybe one day we'll be able to understand that there's another dimension. Or, let's try another one. Morphic fields with the Sheldrake. A morphic field is a kind of sort of habit of nature. Each time a particular form occurs, it's more likely to occur again, you know, whether it's from snowflakes to flowers to humans, etc. And it becomes more likely as it goes on. Now, Sheldrake believed that morphic fields influence patterns of brain activity as well. Not limited by location, which means that, you know, though a person's individual memories must somehow be matched to the pattern of his or her own, you know, unique nervous system, one person's experience can influence another. So this links quite nicely with Jung's idea of a collective unconscious, something that links everyone on a different level. And basically, it's, you know, once something is learned by one person, it becomes easier for somebody else to learn it. Now, American psychologist William McDougall at Harvard University, he discovered by chance that untrained rats were exceptionally quick at learning a task, which was escaping from a water maze, previously mastered by earlier generation of rats in the same strain. And then the same results were picked up by people doing the same experiment, but in Scotland and in Australia later on. And their rats were previously untrained. It was almost like, because these rats had already learnt it in Harvard, that the rat collective unconscious had picked up on how to do it. Now, good old Pavlov, of drooling dog's fame, he made similar observations on several generations of mice trained to feed at the sound of a bell. I don't know what it was with him and bells, but... Now, the first generation took about 300 goes to get it. The second only took about 100 goes to get it. And the third and fourth learnt in 30 goes and 10 goes, respectively. So you can see how quickly it sort of picked up the pace in each generation. Now this theory gives, you know, a possible account of Jung's archetypes and collective unconscious, with, you know, this working through it. Unfortunately, you know, we're still confronted with the observation, you know, synchronistic coincidences are often a great deal more than simple repetitions, you know. It's not like a mouse going to a bell to feed or whatever. You know, they're very different in form because there's several different events. You know, one could be an object, one could be something happening, one's a feeling inside of you. So they're not, you know, it's not in quite the same way. But one more thing, and I was reading about this week. Neuroscientists, you know, are looking into how the brain works, obviously. But they've been noticing that basically our what we are conscious of, so say for example we're told to randomly push a button like that, and they try and measure our brain activity when we push the button. That when we make the conscious decision to push the button, even before we actually push it, actually there's brainwave activity happening before we even consciously make the decision to put it.
6 seconds.
Yeah. So they're going into all weird and wonderful areas of like, is there free will even because of this? And then in 2009, German scientists reported in their neuroscience magazine, they measured the brainwave patterns of 8 pairs of guitarists using EEG, and that while they played a jazz piece. And the researchers found that the guitarist brainwaves were aligned most during 3 pivotal times, when they were syncing up with the metronome, when they began playing the piece, and at points during the composition that demanded the most, you know, playing in harmony. And this synchrony was most prominent in the frontal and central parts of the brain that regulate motor function. Whenever synchrony of behaviour was high, synchrony of brainwaves was also high. Ullmann Lindenberger from the Max Planck Institute of Human Development in Berlin said, but we can't assign a causal role to that synchronizing. While brain synchrony during a duet seems like a given, it is a mystery how it happens, says Lindenberger. One could speculate that this may be related to mirror neurons, the capacity of primates and humans to imagine the action of the other person while performing actions yourself. So the mirror neuron system could be active during synchronized guitar playing. And he goes on to say it may explain other things like, you know, being able to dance in harmony with a partner, or boxing, or, you know, even mother and child bonding. He says, people have an extraordinary capacity to synchronize their actions. When two people concentrate on the same thing, gestures and head movements are highly coordinated, supported by brain synchronicity. We think what we are getting through music has wider implications in social bonding behaviors, are part of those wider implications. So there is, you know, green shoots popping up about synchronicity. But leave you with a word of warning. Don't immediately assume that all synchronicities are positive. Okay? Sometimes they lead to lessons of things we need to learn in life, but you know, you could be deceived into thinking that this is fate or something important that's happened to you and not actually recognise that. Stanislav Grof relates such an experience in his book called When the Impossible Happens, Adventures in Non-Ordinary Reality. And he describes these events he had around meeting his second wife. And all these wonderful synchronicities, you know, they, friends said they should meet, and then they met in this strange place that they didn't expect to meet, and they were sitting behind each other at the cinema, and all these wonderful synchronicities, so that they said, oh wow, this is amazing, we must get married, and then he said his marriage was complete disaster. So you have to look at that bigger picture of the synchronicity, you know, not the actual event. Look at the underlying facts when the synchronicity occurs to be sure you know why you attracted that person, that situation or archetype into your life. As for me, whenever I've talked about synchronicity, I've usually had things happen. And also, I did a big seminar on synchronicity, like a day-long seminar on synchronicity. And while I was researching that, I had some weird synchronicity happen of people I knew. Two people I knew I met at separate events who had the same name, and who ended up having skirts made of the same material that was only available in one town in America when they both lived in the UK, which was really weird. And I can't explain it. And it was meaningful to me, but it won't be to you because you don't care. Anyway, so, you know, what about the paranormal, the unexplained, astrology, ESP, etc.? You know, is synchronicity a helpful analysis for how it works? You know, or should we return to try and look for a truly causal description? Or is it just apophenia?
I suggest
you decide.
Maybe it's two things. A lot of people often look, is it A and B? Is it A and B? Is it A and B? Sometimes A and B.
And probably C and D and E and F.
Well, the point I'm making is that a lot of people are, you know, trying to say, is it all causal, you know, do we live in a predefined universe? Well, it may be true that we do, it also may be true that we influence it.
Oh, I think certainly. And I mean, I think, you know, we're certainly actually coming around to that point of view. I think even you know more mainstream science is coming around to that point of view. I think Jung's, you know, of the meaning always is forever going to lay just outside of science unless we start taking into account, you know, the feelings that people have around the experiences that they're having.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing, isn't it? It's one of those things you can explore yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thank you very much, and may synchronicity shine on you all.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.